Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We've already heard one argument this afternoon with a different panel. And the present panel up here, Justice Meyer, Justice Gabriel, and myself will be hearing three more arguments this afternoon. All right, are y'all ready to proceed? All right, would you announce the first case, please?
The court will now call Severe Enterprises Incorporated versus Newfleet Company. Next to the court, Mr. Jesus Ramirez will argue for the appellant. Mr. Gray R. Brown will argue for the appellate.
Good afternoon, may it please the court, counsel. Today, I wish to address two issues. One is causation in light of circumstantial evidence, and two is the testing provision in the contract in the express warranty in light of the UCC, particularly in provision 2.719 and remedies and damages. This express warranty involved two products, Temelastic and Temscoat. Temelastic was provided in colors tan and orange. Temscoat was provided in the color green. There were 61 5-gallon containers of Temelastic Temscoat. There were 85 5-gallon containers of Temelastic Orange, and there were 18 5-gallon containers of Temscoat Green. Paragraphs 1 and 2 of the warranty provide, 1, that the paint will be free I'm sorry, that the paint will not fade or deteriorate within 5 years of application, and two, that Euclid will cover the repair costs if it so fades. Defendant does not dispute that this is a warranty, an express warranty. To prove breach of warranty, of an express warranty, all that is required of the plaintiff is that the paint fail. Contrary to the vendor's express affirmations or promises that are contained in the written warranty. The paint failed, but not all
of it. Whoa. What's our evidence that the paint failed and caused a problem? Are you just saying it failed and we're not going to worry about causation yet?
Absolutely not. We're going to worry about
streaked. We're going to discolored, but does that mean it was the paint?
Well, Your Honor, we provided circumstantial evidence that, in fact, it was the paint and it was the product that failed.
Okay.
And that is what this case is really all about, circumstantial evidence. And as the court knows, we are required in a circumstantial evidence case, we can prove causation in an express warranty case strictly through circumstantial evidence.
Okay.
We are required to deal with any of those issues that may be raised by the defendant, which might show that there's an intervening fact that was a substantial producing cause of the failure. We were able to provide circumstantial evidence that the paint failed. We were able to provide circumstantial evidence, which I will address, okay, with respect to causation, Your Honor.
Okay.
Only the Temelastic failed, not the Temscoat. The paint was applied to 52,000 square feet of area in an 8-floor hotel in Beaumont, Texas. The paint was applied by the contractor, by my client Severe, with the same procedure for both paints, for both products. Only the Temelastic failed. The Temscoat did not fail.
Did you not allege that the Temscoat failed in your pleading?
I don't believe so. If we did, that's certainly in error.
Okay.
The paint was used on all of the floors, on the walls on which the sun prevailed, on the walls on which shade prevailed, and only the Temelastic failed. Plaintiff applied the same identical procedures in using both of the products. The product literature required that the paint be applied for both products using the same identical procedure. Only the time elastic failed. Plaintiff proved through circumstantial evidence that the time elastic failed to avoid fading and deterioration. This was the cause of the plaintiff's economic injury. The following is the circumstantial evidence contained in the record. One, the fading of the paint required a complete repainting of the walls, which the plaintiff paid for. Euclid's representatives confirmed that the fading and deterioration had occurred in the entire building. I will interject, as I mentioned earlier, that in order for the plaintiff to make out this case purely on circumstantial evidence, it was nonetheless required to show that no intermediate cause was a producing cause of the paint's failure. Notably, the defendant raised no evidence which pointed whatsoever in any probative value which would show that the plaintiff's application of the paint was a producing cause, a substantial producing cause of the failure. Defendant also provided no evidence whatsoever of any probative value that would show that the substrate, the condition of the substrate, was a producing cause of the fading or the failure.
It's not the defendant's burden, it's your burden.
I understand, Your Honor, but in terms of circumstantial evidence, we are required to address evidence that purportedly would show that the intermediate act was the cause of a failure. We're not required to disprove everything in the world, but only those acts that are or conduct that is raised by the evidence.
What you cited as your circumstantial evidence is simply that there was discoloration. So the fact that there was discoloration is circumstantial evidence that it was the product's fault. That's basically, you want us to presume causation because there was discoloration.
No, I want to continue.
There's more circumstantial evidence, I hope.
Right. Okay. And I would point to two particular acts or conduct of the defendant. On the one hand, the defendant replaced or substituted the temp elastic with Temscoat. The defendant provided the plaintiff paint, replaced in the entire temp elastic product with Temscoat, and provided instructions to the plaintiff to repaint the entire building. Okay. Certainly, the jury could infer from that fact that the defendant was admitting that the temp elastic had failed, and that the temp elastic had been the causation of the fading and deterioration of the paint. By in fact providing the Temscoat, and again the Temscoat never failed. Secondly, Euclid took it upon itself to undertake laboratory testing, and in that testing, they were not able to find the true cause of the failure of their own product. It seems to us, Your Honors, that is circumstantial evidence from which the jury could infer further that the plaintiff's acts or conduct were not an intervening cause, because the lab test could not show that anything that the plaintiff did in terms of applying the paint was a producing cause of the damage, and certainly they could not show that any of the substrate was a producing cause of the damage. Hence, the circumstantial evidence provides the jury sufficient basis on which to infer that the product was the producing cause of the plaintiff's economic damages. Now, it seems to us that creates a prima facie case which requires the defendant then to rebut that. Secondly, I'd like to address the modification of the express warranty. And by that I mean the language in the contract, in paragraph 3 of the contract, which I believe the defendant argues is a 2.719 limitation of damages or exclusive remedy. We have no quarrel with limitation of remedies in the contract. That's certainly permitted under 2.719. However, when the purported damages or limitation of damages clause completely modifies The underlying warranty, it completely changes the essence of the contract. The underlying warranty is an express warranty that if the product fails to perform as promised, that will be a breach. When you get down to paragraph 3 of the warranty, and Euclid contends that we now must show the existence of a defect in the product, and that we must use scientific evidence to show a defect in the product, and that we must use scientific evidence to show that that was a causation of the plaintiff's damages, we are completely changing the scope of the underlying warranty. We're not only modifying the warranty, we're in fact disclaiming it completely. And under 2.719, any modification of the underlying warranty must be clearly articulated, must be clearly expressed, and certainly must not be ambiguous. Thirdly, I'd like to address the matter of the testing provisions and whether those are in fact an express warranty, a promise, a covenant, a conditional, or a condition precedent, and if so, what it is that they mean. But the provision basically states that Euclid reserves the right to undertake laboratory testing or petrographic testing in order to determine the true fault of a failure in the paint. Now, we agree with Euclid that they had no obligation to undertake the testing, but if they did undertake the testing, they certainly had certain promises that they made in the express warranty as to how the testing would be conducted. And the underlying promises were that the laboratory testing be conducted by an independent lab, that it be fair and impartial, methodology of testing be one that would be appropriate for this type of a product, and that true cause of the failure be identified. They failed to do that. Now, I don't know whether that's an express warranty, a condition precedent, a covenant, but it's certainly in writing, it's certainly there in the contract, and it seems to me that the trial court must address it. What exactly is this language, and what does it mean? And we contend that it means one of three things. Either it is rationally an obligation that the defendant has, if and when it denies the claim, that would be pre-litigation, that it must undertake laboratory testing to find the true cause of the failure. Two, a rational basis would be that post-litigation, if there is a prima facie case that the defendant must come forward and in fact tender laboratory testing that accomplishes what they promised. Or three, it is entirely ambiguous and it must be interpreted against the defendant. In any case, that's an obligation that the court would have to undertake in this express warranty case. It seems to me, Your Honors, that in a case where we have a no evidence review, that we must consider whether the jury could have disregarded all of these purported acts and conduct and uses that presumably could have been intermediate causes of the failure. And the jury, it is our view, under the evidence in the record, could have completely disregarded any of the allegations that were brought forth by the defendants as intermediate causes of the failure. In particular, again, I go back to the two issues of the conduct of Euclid. One, the subsequent remedial measures which they undertook by completely replacing the product, when they could have provided the same product with specific instructions, and we could have used the same product, they decided to reject that product and rely only on the TAMS code. That is certainly evidence that the jury could infer that there's an admission that by Euclid that their thermoelastic product is defective and in fact is the source of the failure. And secondly, by not moving forward with a laboratory testing that was fair and objective by an independent lab, they certainly failed to provide evidence that we believe they were obligated to provide once having exercised that right to undertake the lab testing. Thank you.
Ramirez.
Yes, sir.
The lab tests were done, and was it after the lab tests were done that the Tamiscote was provided?
That is hard for me to tell because we obtained the lab test report through production. And I can't recall right now, Your Honor, whether the report is dated before or after the Tamiscote substitute was provided.
Well, my concern is that you're relying upon the action of Euclid in providing the Tamiscote as circumstantial evidence that they made a determination that the Tamiscolastic was a failure and that it was and that the streaking was caused by the use of the Tamiscolastic in the first place. Is that right?
That is correct, sir.
All right. And so then if the testing was done before they provided the Tamiscote, and when the Tamiscope was provided and applied to the hotel, that cured the problem. Am I right in our sequence?
Absolutely.
Then I'm having trouble figuring out how the replacing of the thermoelastic by the Tamiscope could be counted against the defendant if in fact what they did was honor the warranty provision and provide a means of correcting of the problem, then I'm having trouble connecting that to a circumstantial evidence of showing that they were recognizing that the thermoelastic was in fact the problem.
Let me differ on one point and then attempt to clarify. I'm not suggesting that the providing of the Tamiscote is incontrovertible evidence that the product, the Tamiscolastic, was in fact the cause. What I'm saying is that the jury would be permitted to make a reasonable inference that by substituting Tamiscote for Tamiscolastic, given that this company has all the manufacturing data, they have control of the product, they have control of the plastic resins, the tint that comes from different manufacturers, and they mix it, then certainly the jury could infer that by completely rejecting 90% of the paint and substituting it with Tamiscote, that certainly the plaintiff was not the cause of the failure, but it was the Tamiscolastic.
They wouldn't have tried to correct it if they didn't recognize it was their fault.
I think that's a reasonable inference by a jury under the circumstances, and then in no evidence review, what else do I have, Your Honor?
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
In the back of my mind, in products cases, you can't use remedial measures to show culpability. Now, I'm not saying that applies to this DTPA breach of warranty case, but the reason for that is it throws a chilling effect on going back and fixing the problem if you can use fixing the problem to show culpability.
I totally agree with you, and I think that in product liability cases, you in fact may have that policy concern. I don't think you have it in an express warranty case where it's not a personal injury that we're concerned with. So there's no safety issues here. And certainly there's exceptions from the rule. And in this case, obviously the evidence came in without objection. I have not found yet a case in the express warranty area where there's not a personal injury, an injury caused by the product, where subsequent remedial measures are going to be excluded as part of the evidence.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Ramirez. I'm Greg Brown. I'm the lawyer for Euclid Chemical Company. We are a manufacturer of coatings. We are not an insurer that our products will always look exactly the way the plaintiff wants them to look, no matter how the products are used. And of course, we did issue an express warranty, which speaks for itself. And with all due respect to opposing counsel, I would say it does not say what he just indicated it does say. But at its base, this case is about causation. I would say that I was somewhat baffled by the approach to this case by plaintiff. It was almost as if they thought this was a res ipsa Lockwater case in which they did not have to put forward any evidence of causation. At various points during the underlying litigation, they made an effort to designate experts, although even that's not quite clear because they indicate that although they're designating them, they had not retained them. And at the time of trial, they chose not to make an effort to call the individual whom I thought they would call. That's a gentleman named Housewright, who had issued a report, flawed as it was. And I, of course, would have had arguments against him being able to testify because his expert opinions and report were not timely produced to the defense. Nonetheless, the only testimony at trial that was provided by the plaintiff was from Lonnie Sevier, very nice man, been in the business for a while, but he readily admitted that he was not an expert and had no evidence whatsoever to offer the jury or the court with respect to causation. Now, this argument regarding inferences with respect to my client's decision to provide an alternative product, I'd like to address that briefly. First of all, I would take the position that's not evidence of causation. The fact of the matter is a defendant in that position is sort of danged if they do and danged if they don't. Because if I don't provide some sort of help to this gentleman, we're going to look bad. And then if we do, as just happened here a few moments ago, we're blamed for it and we're told that that's an indication that there was a defect in the prior product and that that defect was the cause of the problem. Nothing could be further from the truth. We were trying to be cooperative. We were trying to come forward and be helpful. And here we are now facing that argument. But I would also say, even if Lonnie Sevier had testified that this product was the cause of the problem, or if this inference that is now being suggested were some evidence in that respect, it is still not good enough. Because in a products case of this nature, there are simply too many possible reasons for the coating to fail. If this were a situation in which, for example, let's take something that has one element, let's say a gold ring. Let's say I buy a gold ring for my wife, and my wife puts it on her finger, and 2 weeks later she has a green finger. Well, we could reasonably conclude that the only thing that could be wrong would be that it's not the 14 karat gold that the jeweler told us it was.
Or the ring's on too tight.
Perhaps that. There are always other potential causes.
To gold.
But really, when I think about this case, I think about it being like a company who provides seed, let's say corn, and they advertise that with this corn, you're capable of getting 200 bushels per acre. And in fact, the farmer buys the corn and he takes it back and he plants it in a field that is totally played out, and then there's a drought, and he puts the wrong pesticide on, and when harvest time comes, he gets 25 bushels per acre and his corn's full of worms. And then he comes back to the seed manufacturer and says, aha, it's your fault. That's really this situation. You know, the Supreme Court has addressed this issue in a somewhat similar context, and it's in the case called Nissan versus Armstrong. This is a case that involved unintentional acceleration. And I want to just read briefly from what the Supreme Court said in this respect. We have consistently required competent expert testimony and objective proof that a defect caused the acceleration. And we cite a case in our appellate brief as well for this principle. There's another recent case not cited, which is Building Products versus TAMKO, T-A-M-K-O, 2013 Westlaw 5604738, that addresses the same point, that is Building Products Plus versus TAMKO, 2013 WL 5604738. That's a first district case. But the Nissan case, I think, is very much in point with our situation here. And in fact, the Supreme Court noted that it had previously said the very same thing in the Ford Motor Company versus Ridgeway case, in which, in a case involving an engine fire, the court said there were simply too many potential causes to assume from the one that the other must have been the culprit. Well, that's our exact situation here. So as I'm sitting in the courtroom and I'm listening to the plaintiff's case, it is readily apparent to me, and I submit to the trial court, that there was zero evidence of causation. And therefore, I had no choice but to move for a directed verdict, and I would submit that Judge Ramirez had no choice but to grant our motion in that respect. There are several other reasons why the directed verdict was appropriate on the various causes of action. There was no evidence of a defect. There was no evidence of a breach of a warranty. There was no evidence of a breach of contract. Indeed, there's no evidence there is a contract. There is no contract. And others as well that we put in our admittedly somewhat too long brief. But at its base, this is a classic example of the plaintiff failing to meet its burden of proof by coming forward with evidence of causation, be it proximate cause or producing cause with respect to the DTPA claims, or showing that the damages are a result of a failure to comply with a contract, which in this case does not exist. So I would submit that the court really need not go any farther than that. I would say briefly, with respect to the warranty, the express warranty, it does not require that my client perform testing. It says that my client reserves the right to perform testing. And Justice Meyer, to your point, the testing was performed by a gentleman in-house named Frank Gay, and he determined that there was calcite, or calcium carbonate, essentially limestone, I guess, on the back of the samples that were taken. It turned out that the substrate here contained Portland cement. In our product guidelines, which I'll tell you Mr. Severe was not familiar with, but they state that if there is a cement or masonry surface, you have to permit 28 days to pass before the product is applied. In this case,
wet on wet is what you're saying.
Well, wet on wet, Your Honor, has more to do with the first coat and the second coat of the material. Now I'm speaking of the substrate. So I don't know if you're familiar with EFA's exterior insulation finish systems, but basically it's a sandwich they put on the outside of buildings. We see it all the time. Now, this building may very well have it. I'm not sure. But the point is that that coating material, that EFA's material, which became the substrate for my client's product, contained Portland cement. And there was a lot of evidence and discussion about that during the plaintiff's case in chief. And so the testing that was done by Mr. Gay with Euclid showed that there was calcite, in fact, from this Portland. The TAMSCO product, at that point, many, many months had passed, and at that stage, there was no doubt that the underlying substrate had cured properly. And in addition, the TAMSCO was better able to handle that type of a substrate. My client was unaware that the EFAs contained Portland cement, as Mr. Severe admitted during trial. So
if the TAMSCO had been used in the first place, would that have still had the same problem with having the Portland cement at it?
Perhaps, if you didn't let it cure long enough.
28 days.
Yes. Now, Your Honor, I don't want to represent that I remember exactly what the TAMSCO product data sheet says in that respect.
I don't know either. I'm just going by what I read in the briefs.
Right. That's probably the case. But by that point, as I say, months had passed. So it seemed like the right thing to do, to provide Mr. Severe with this additional product. As I say, I have a great deal of respect for the man. I think he was an honorable individual, but I think his approach to this case was wrong. He just simply did not come forward with the proof necessary to sustain any of the causes of action alleged. And this idea that the court should instead adopt this novel approach where we say the plaintiff need only come up with a prima facie case and then the burden of production or proof shifts to the defense, that is simply not supported by a single case in the state of Texas. There's an opinion out of the state of New Jersey that sort of in a way says that, but as I recall, that case ultimately lands on the implied warranty, not the express, I'm not certain. But in any event, there's no law to that effect in the state of Texas. We would be totally rewriting an area of law in which there is at least 60 years of case law. So that's our position.
I'd like to ask you an additional question, Mr. Brown. I'm looking now at page 4 of the appellant's brief, and there is there quoted what purports to be the specific or pertinent portion of the warranty. And the words say this warranty covers failure of repairs subject to normal and usual exposure, but excluding failures due to acts of God, unusual weather phenomena, failures of substratas, faulty or inadequate design, structural defects, another continuing list of things that are excluded. But I'm focusing on the first part of that. First of all, do you agree that that's the appropriate focus for the language and the warranty that we're looking at here on appeal?
Well, actually, Your Honor, I would consider those to be exceptions to when the warranty would apply.
Yeah, I'm not talking about the exclusions. I'm talking about the first part of it that says this warranty covers failure of repairs.
Subject to normal and usual exposure and then excluding various things.
Yes, my concern is that I understand the evidence to be that when once the Tamscoat was put on the building, there wasn't any more problems.
Well, it is true that once
the Tamscoat... And if the warranty is dealing with a failure of repairs, wasn't the repairs, the placing of the Tamscoat on the exterior as opposed to the Tamelastic?
And the Tamscoat did not fail.
Yeah, that's my whole question is why, if that's the case, how does the warranty apply? There wasn't any failure of the repairs.
Let me first say, and maybe I shouldn't do this, but I concede this is not a work of art, this language in this warranty. However, it is quite clear there is no way to read this warranty that relieves the plaintiff of his burden of proof to come forward with causation. The failure of repairs, Your Honor, as I understand it, what happened was Hurricane Ike blew through town in Beaumont in September of 2008. And there was a damage. This building, like many, were damaged. And so the repairs is actually talking about the application of the Tamelastic, not the Tamscoat later. That was a subsequent remedial measure, so to speak, where my client agreed to provide some product, despite the fact it had no legal obligation to do so. But this warranty makes it quite clear that our obligations only arise when there is, as it says, a determination that the product was the cause. And there just is no such evidence in this case.
Further questions?
No. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Judge Mayer, the repair was the Tamelastic. 90% of the 52,000 square feet was painted with Tamelastic. That was the repair. That is what failed. The subsequent remedial measures were using Tamscoat. That fixed the problem. The original Tamscoat, 10% on the building, green color, never failed.
So the language that I was reading there about the warranty covers failure repairs is talking about the initial application of the Tamelastic.
Precisely. It's a very artfully drafted warranty that I'm sure most lawyers today wouldn't draft, but in any case, that's what we have. A couple of points. circumstantial evidence, cases on point that contradict entirely what the defendant is saying. Mott v. Reds Safe, a Houston 2007 case. Mott is M-O-T-T. Ford Motor Company versus Tidwell, 563 Southwest 2nd, 835. General Supply and Equipment, a 1972 case out of Tyler. Delane Scott, 2012, Northern District of Texas, that's the Latch and Drano case. In all of these cases, in every single one of them, they're all express warranty cases. And in every single one of them, circumstantial evidence was the sole evidence that was used to prove causation. What counsel here is talking about is a products case where you have a risk of physical or personal injury to a person. That is not what we're talking about here. This is not a defect case. This is not a product defect case. The warranty does not warrant against a defect. Nowhere does it say that. This is what it warrants. Euclid Chemical Company warrants products to conform to the quality standards as stated in the specific product literature. The product literature provides that the paint will not fade or deteriorate. That is the extent of the warranty. The warranty does not say that it warrants against defects in the product. We are not required to show under the warranty with scientific evidence, expert testimony, that there was a product defect.
No, but you have under the warranty the burden to show that it was a cause of the failure, the product was, and not how it was applied or not some other factor. It was the product. And I don't think anybody's arguing that you can't prove causation by circumstantial evidence. But what I'm still not, at least I'm not grasping, is what your circumstantial evidence was that it was the product and not how it was applied that caused the failure. Other than there was an attempt at a repair later on down the road.
The circumstantial evidence in this case, the two primary pieces of evidence that show that the jury could infer that there was substantial evidence beyond a scintilla was the following. One, that Euclid replaced all of the TAMS elastic with a TAMS coat. The jury is entitled to make that inference. Number two, that Euclid conducted testing and that Euclid was not able to show that the plaintiff's conduct or application or the substrate was the cause. They simply did not provide that. Now, this is evidence. This is evidence that was admitted. It's just not just an argument. Now, the defendant argues this corn case. That is an excellent case for a products case. This is not the same case. This is a warranty case. The warranty is the aesthetic, the color. That's what they were warranting, that the tan would hold for 5 years, that the green would hold for 5 years, and that the orange would hold for 5 years. It simply did not. The issue of the substrate, you know, I went through a lengthy questioning during the trial, and the issue of the substrate, there was no evidence that the substrate was concrete. Certainly concrete takes 28 days to get hard and to cure, and it cracks. And if it cracks, one would see that the product might not help. There was no evidence that the substrate was concrete. There was no evidence that even if the substrate had poured in cement, that had anything to do with causing the problem. Zero. No evidence whatsoever. If there were, then certainly Euclid would have shown it. They had at their command scientists. They produced testing. They could not show that plaintiff had done anything at all. There was an intermediate act that caused a problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Your case is submitted, and we will adjourn until 3 o'clock, at which time we will return and hear the final two cases.